On behalf of Sister Mary, Sister Ursula, and myself, and all the sisters here at 851, we welcome you to the joint oblate meeting and to all our little guests. We're so happy today to be able to have Teresa Salier. I always mess up people's names, I hope that's all right. She has been practicing centering prayer for 29 years and teaching it and other contemplative prayer practices for over 25 years. She holds a Master's of Arts degree in theology from Fordham University and works as a web developer for a major corporation in New York. Teresa lives in Bayonne, so she's close by. She's the area coordinator for contemplative outreach for this part of New Jersey. She's very active with contemplative outreach. She was telling me that they sent her even to Iceland to do a few teaching programs. So you can imagine how good she is. So we're really looking forward. Without further ado, this is Teresa.
He spends time with his Father. And I'm happy to be talking to oblates because you know what I mean. About quiet prayer and about the importance of prayer and importance of spending time. So one of my teachers, my spiritual teacher was Mary Mazowski. She was one of the founders of Contemplative Outreach. And she said that one of her gifts was how-tos. You know, and in my introduction, Sister Cynthia mentioned that I have a master's in theology. I do. And I earned that before I started doing centering prayer. So I say, before centering prayer, I knew a lot about God, but I didn't know God. Because I think it is prayer and spending time in prayer which really deepens that relationship with God. That's my perspective. And so one of the very practical things that Mary came up with some prayer practices, which I do teach, the forgiveness prayer, the welcome prayer, and she had these seven deadly attitudes, which she referred to. And I was like, well, those are very nice. And over the last couple of years, I've started to talk about the seven deadly attitudes, because I think they're so, from my perspective, they're so important that I can be aware of what is happening in my life with God and with other people. So I belong to the Archdiocese of New York, and we have a new archbishop as of January, Joseph Cardinal Tobin. And I was able to listen to his installation homily on the internet. I mean, the internet is so wonderful for many good things. But anyway, I was so struck by the book, by part of his homily. And I just want to share what he said in his homily. He said, at a dinner party recently, I was asked, what is the greatest challenge the church faces today? I thought a moment and replied, the chasm between faith and life. My questioner looked at me quizzically and remarked, she didn't expect that answer. I imagine that she was ready for any one of the so-called hot button issues that dominate the discourse, both inside and outside the church. As noisy and divisive as those questions might be, they don't worry me as much as a growing trend that seems to isolate us, convincing us to neatly compartmentalize our life, subtly seducing us to go to Mass on Sunday and for the rest of the week do whatever we think we need to get by. I was convicted by those words, hearing those words. And I had the opportunity, the privilege to attend Mass this morning before breakfast, and it's the feast of St. Catherine of Siena, a mystic. I know very little about it, and I would be a liar to pretend I know more than this one quote, because I think it is such a powerful quote. The quote from her is, "If you were who you are called to be, you would set the world on fire." And that sort of was my reaction when I heard those words from Cardinal Tobin that day when he was being installed. Am I all that I am called to be? I have to be honest. No. And I say no because I can get to a certain level of spiritual laziness. I can get to a plateau which says, well, I'm doing pretty good, God. God never tells me back, but really tells me back if you watch me, especially if I'm in that frame of mind. But I think we all have been that place where and I'm not saying that we're not good people, I know who we are. But I know that I can be better. I know that I can live the gospel message more wholeheartedly than I do live it. And so I want to share with you the seven deadly attitudes, because they are part of what interfere with my living my Christianity, my Catholicism wholeheartedly. Does that make sense? Okay. So, again, you have it on the handout and sheet with them. Attachments, aversions, comparisons, anticipations, expectations, competition, and judgments. I'm convicted of all those. And the interesting thing about that list is they become more toxic the further we go down on that list. So I'll break them open one by one. Attachments. How about being good? Anyone attached to being good? Looking good? That's me. That's my program. Being right? That has been my curse for a good part of my life, you know. And being right, you know, Jesus doesn't say anything about that in the Gospels, does he? He speaks about love, but he doesn't talk about being right. How about being helpful? Anyone attached to being helpful? Being nice? Attached to exercise? Family? Happiness? Internet browsing. One of my friends who I used to work with in Contemplative Hour, she's retired, she's a nursing home now. When she retired, and this was, she retired, actually, about 10 years ago, when she retired from her job, she had two phone lines. One for her internet connection and one so people could get in touch with her. Because after she retired, that's when she did. She lived on the internet. Now, I mentioned that I really appreciate the opportunity to listen to Cardinal Tobin's installation homily on the internet. It has wonderful uses. I am a web developer for AT&T. That's good. It pays my salary. But it's not all life. You know, the internet is just a little bit of life. And then there's, I think, also the attachments of some of our social media, Facebook, Twitter. I think those things can become very engaged with them. And even our devices, our smartphones. You know, are we attached? How attached are we? And then what about our aversions? Anyone have any aversions? Anyone here have an aversion to being free? I do on a certain level, I know that. You know? And that is, isn't that the gospel invitation? Part of it. I believe it is. To be free. To be free from all those things that keep me from receiving God's grace. St. Augustine, 3rd century, said, God wants to fill our hands with good things, but can't because of all of the things that we are clinging to. Anyone cling to anything? I do. So that I have an aversion in a certain sense to people free. Maybe we have aversions to people of other cultures. This is one of mine. I have an aversion to self-centered people. That's who they are. That's just who they are. And maybe we have an aversion to people who are messy. Maybe we have an aversion to people who are in need. People who are late. People who are early. Being alone. Being careful of what, and be careful of what you are afraid of, because it may manifest in your life. And these things, these aversions, they're not very conscious. I'm not, purposely avoiding these things, but they're coming up. And what they're doing is they are not necessarily making me the most loving Teresa I can be. That I do know. And they are, in a certain sense, a block to God's grace in my life. And what about comparisons? Ever do any comparisons? Me, I do centering and prayer twice a day. So on a certain level, I can say, I'm better than those people who don't do it. We do it. We do comparisons, and we don't have to. We don't have to do things like that. I know when I'm guilty of this, when someone tells a story, I have to tell my version. And one of the things I want to talk about with attitudes is to make us aware of our behavior, more aware than we were when we started the day. Because when we're aware of our behavior, we see it, and then we can stop it and let God change it. Because I truly believe that God is the agent of change in the world, in my life. And one thing it still puzzles me. Somebody is having an operation. So, work is really, really good because I get to see a lot of behavior. How people interact with one another. I'm just there. And I don't have necessarily emotional investment I have with, say, my family. Why, when someone is having a surgery, does somebody have to tell the horror story about somebody who had the same surgery? Oh, you haven't had surgery? I don't know. My cousin had that same surgery. And after the surgery, she was paralyzed. But because if we're not aware of our behavior, we don't even see that. We don't even see necessarily the impact on it. And when we come to the area of comparisons, there is a little more. I said, as we go down the list, they become more toxic. And with this particular comparisons, I'm consciously doing these things. With the attachments and aversions, they're part of my unconscious makeup, by and large. But with comparisons, I'm like, I'm doing something actively. My teacher, Mary, she used to say, if you want to suffer, have expectations. Just think about it. Have you ever planned to meet a friend you haven't seen for years, and you have all expectations, in your mind, you figure out the whole conversation, and then at the end of the meeting, it's a disaster because there was no encounter. Because your expectations were trying to control the relationship, the person. And along with expectations, how about anticipation? Anticipate that something will happen. There's a group of group of people I sit by in my office, and they do the group lottery thing. When the jackpot raises to, you know, $100 million, and they actually say the day that, on the day that the lottery is going to go off, well, I will never see you again. Because of their anticipation that they're going to win the lottery. You know, they're still there, by the way, because, you know, that's a big, big hope. But we all have these expectations, anticipations of how things should be. And what I found over the years, I just present myself to the situation and let the situation evolve and let God work in the situation. That's one of the biggest awarenesses I have at this point in my life. It's I show up and God works. If I leave space for God to work. If I don't have to be in control. And giving up control, it can be a challenge, can it? Competition. The need to be better than, the need to win, the need to dominate. The organization I work for, Father Kingdom of God, which was founded by a Trappist monk, Father Thomas Keating, in 1984. And Father Thomas loves to tell the story about the monk during Lent. And what happened was this man came in, and he had been a high-powered businessman. He came in, and, you know, he was going to, and he lived a good life, in quotes, before he entered the monastery. One of the things that he loved to do was he loved to go out on a Saturday night and drink everybody under the table. You know, that was part of his domination. And he came into the monastery, and, you know, he's going to be the best monk. You know, he's going to compete on the best, on the level of best monk. And he came, and this was way, way back, maybe 50 years ago, we had the fast, the Lenten fast for Trappists was bread and water. And Father Thomas tells the story that as Lent progresses, you see fewer and fewer people in chapel, because they're dropping like flies. But this man, he stayed to the end, to the Easter Vigil. He was in chapel all the time for all the hours of prayer. And at the end of the Easter Vigil, he felt such an exaltation because he had fasted everybody under the table instead of drinking them under the table. But, you know, even in spiritual things, we can tend to compete, can't we? You know? And I'm going to, well, you know, you're shaking your head. And I think the thing that is it's very interesting. One of the things I heard when I attended my first sentient prayer workshop many, many years ago was the phrase, to walk in the presence of the Lord in the land of the living. And I think that's a very powerful, very timely invitation to us in our current culture. To be who we are in the culture we live in. And the thing with the competition, it's very American. You know, really, it's part of our culture. It really is. You know, we're great. And I do my centering prayer in the morning, and I'm really happy for that, because I think I start the day off positive, and other prayers too. And so then I get to go about my day, and I don't know what happens in my prayer, and that's fine. Yeah. God does, and I trust God, that God's working, and God should. And one day I got up, and I went into my car, and I went to and I have to take the turnpike for a little bit of space. And I don't know what was happening with me, but there was a little bit of competitive edge that morning. As we come out of the toll booth, I have this idea in my head. Of course, nobody knows what it is, but my idea is this is how the bird should work. And this particular morning, someone decided he started to come into my lane before I thought it was appropriate. And so we went like that for quite a bit. It's a long entrance ramp, quite a bit. And then I finally realized this is stupid. By that time, it's probably only 40 miles an hour. And I just stopped, and the man went ahead of me, and then I looked behind me in the mirror. And the closest vehicle was about 50 yards away, and it was a taxi cab. And I think, this is what I projected, that the taxi cab driver said, I am staying away from these idiots. Because, I mean, that was not good behavior on my part. But it was just, competition can come up from deep within us, you know? But it's also something that we're involved in you know, more active than, you know, attachment to aversions. I mentioned I work for AT&T, and, you know, we're great on telecommuting, which is good. You know, it's also good for Teresa because if it snows a lot in the winter, I get to work from home, which is really good. And one day, and it's also good because sometimes it provides a safety net for me. One day I was working at home, and one of my friends at work went to the doctor's. And she came back home, and we had a conversation about the doctor's. I said, well, how was your doctor's appointment? She said, oh, you know, everything looked well. She said, and when I, and my blood pressure was, you know, 120 over 80. I said, well, the last time I had my blood pressure taken, it was 110 over 70. And then I realized I was competing on the level of blood pressure. It's so insane. And so I said, quick, and I can think pretty quickly. So, well, what do I do? I said, I'm just going to move right through. She didn't even notice that. But that just said that competitiveness can sort of, you know, come out. Now, the most toxic are judgments. And we hear in our scriptures, we don't hear necessarily a lot about attachments, but that we do. You know, Jesus tells us not to cling to things, right? But it's clear in the New Testament, judge not and you will not be judged. Correct? That's it. I thought it was a pretty innocuous judgment until 7 years ago when a friend of mine developed lung cancer. She hadn't smoked for many, many years. She had a change of life. She moved from her house in northern New Jersey where she raised her family to a retirement community in central Jersey. It really didn't work out well. And sometimes when we go through turmoil, we get ill. That's part of life. And she developed lung cancer. And I remember a mutual friend, I remember telling a mutual friend that she had developed lung cancer. And my friend said to me, what do you expect? She was a smoker. And I was just startled by that response. And the woman said to me, she's not an uncaring person. But it was just that judgment intent to yeet out everybody, you know? A friend of mine recently had a hip replacement surgery. And you know what she discovered in a deep, deep way, convalescing from that surgery? That she's not in charge of the world. But what she found out was she tries to orchestrate the world. You know, her husband, her children, do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And in that judgment. But what I found out when I had that incident with my friend, with two friends, one of them judging, the other one had lung cancer, I realized for the first time, what happens when we judge other people? We objectify them. They're not as human as they are. We're not saying. You know, we're not necessarily loving them. We're saying, as my friend said, well, she deserved it. She took risky behavior. And I just found out it was so startling to me. So judgments, conscious or unconscious, are wanting to belittle, wanting to manipulate, wanting to control. They are. And you know, at times are relatively benign. I can say to my sister, well, you know, I think it would have been better if you used baby spinach instead of mixed greens in the salad. My judgment. Judgments, we can laugh at somebody, at something somebody did. We do that? Look at Mary, she burned the tape turkey again this year. Is that a loving thing?
Mm-hmm.
Is that a loving thing?
Sure.
So in a certain sense, what judgments are, is there a triumphant reign of the ego? That's it, ego. The ego wants steroids. And the ego, our egos, wants to rationalize, justify, glorify everything I do. It wants to make me the center of the universe. That doesn't work well, trust me. I prefer my life with God at the center of my life. But when I'm in this type of behavior where I am judging, God is not necessarily at that moment in the center of my life. And another example of judgment, sarcasm. You know, I may get a laugh, but at whose expense do I get the laugh? And passive aggressive behavior. Not that anyone here is that, except for me. And a friend of mine shared a very good cartoon about passive aggressive behavior with me several years ago. And what it was a Great Dane. And a Great Dane would pause on somebody's shoulder, licking their face, and peeing on their feet. Passive aggressive behavior. You know? I'm saying maybe something nice to you, but it's got that edge. It's got that, you know, whatever. It's got that twist. These attitudes are deadly because they're not free. And they interfere with the life of God in us. They interfere with God's grace in our life. So powerful. One of my favorite spiritual books, maybe not spiritual, but for me it is, a book called Addiction and Grace by Gerald May. And in that book, and so Gerald May was a baby doctor in the Vietnam War. And he came home from the Vietnam War, and he was going to cure all the drug addicts. He didn't last long at that. He got burned out very quickly. And then he wound up founding being part of a spiritual institute, a contemplative spiritual institute in Washington, D.C., Shalem. But in that book, he's a man of science, a psychiatrist, in that book, Addiction and Grace, he says, grace is the most powerful force in the universe. Period. No qualifiers. And I think that is what we were, that's what I was taught. Am I always acting that way? No, I have to be honest, no. But I think it is very powerful and very active. God wants to act in our lives. But with all this junk, it makes it difficult. Because all of these seven deadly attitudes, it's about Teresa being in charge. Teresa looking good, Teresa being right. I mentioned Father Thomas Keating, the founder of Contemplative Adoration, 94-year-old Trappist monk. And one of the things he said is, we are not called to be paragons of virtue. I failed that test really bad. We're called to be channels of grace. Channels of grace, how powerful. And we, all of us sitting here, have had moments like that, where something's happened, and we know that we weren't doing it. And the more that we get out of our ego, the more that we get free from these deadly attitudes, the more that God can work through us, which is why I'm sharing them with you today, so that more than we can be free. So they're deadly, they block the free flow of grace in us. And they're deadly because they keep us from growing. And one of my perceptions, one of my beliefs at this point in my life, is that one of the graces of aging, there are graces in aging. Our culture doesn't want to, we don't believe it. And that, just as an aside, would be very foolish. Because boomers and people older, they have a lot of disposable income, so they really should market to them. But anyway, that's another thing. But one of the graces, one of the joys, the graces of aging, the benefits of aging, is that as we age, we are called into deeper intimacy, deeper union That's my experience. That's my experience if I get out of God's way and let God work with me. I once heard one of the founders of architects of the Center of Prayer method that we teach in Contemplative Outreach. Well, there were three chapters, Thomas Keating, Basil Pennington, and William Benninger. Basil Pennington has gone on to glory. And one of the things I heard once heard Father Basil say, he was talking about the Baltimore Catechism, as I learned, as I was catechized. And what's the first question of the Baltimore Catechism? Why did God make me? God made me to know him, to love him, and serve him in this world, and be happy with him in the next. And Father Basil said that was a great discredit to God and to us. Because we're meant to be happy with God while we are still in these containers. We're meant to be happy with God in this world. But we have to get rid of all the stuff. We have to let God work through us, work through a lot of the stuff we carry in our ego. There's one gospel passage where Jesus, in healing, he says, be open. There are more than one. He says, be open. And one time when I heard that liturgy, I was just so struck with it. I forgot that. Be open. And I was struck with it because I realized how unopen I was. And yet that is the invitation to open. To open. Not to guard, to be vulnerable. To be vulnerable in our prayer, in our relationships, wherever we are, to be open. And that's who Jesus worked. And these daily attitudes, they keep me from opening. They keep me from seeing the world behind what I see. I'm very, very fortunate in many ways. God has been very good to me. One of the ways I'm very, very fortunate is all of my education was Catholic. It was very high quality, too. Beyond that, I say it was wonderful because wherever I was learning, mystery was always permissible. Because as we accumulate birthdays, as we advance in our journeys, don't we, I'll speak for myself, I've begun to understand that there are things that I cannot explain because it's mystery. And that's good, and open to mystery. And when I open to mystery, I'm opening to God. And the deadly attitudes keep me from opening. So, what would I suggest as antidotes to these attitudes? With attachments, be aware. Be aware of them. One of the things I do with a Lenten practice every year is I give up candy. Now, I didn't say it was a big candy eater until Lenten. And I'm sitting at my desk at work, and I'm frustrated, and I want pop a piece of candy in my mouth. Well, there is none in that. But just be aware and pray for the grace of awareness to see your behavior as it is, to see how you're not free. And with aversions, face the aversions, encounter it in steps. If you're afraid of heights, well, maybe go into a wall and look down. Don't go to the top of Freedom Tower or top of the Empire State. But face them. Face the aversions that we have. Very, very important. Because aversions, if we don't deal with them, if they're something like fears, they just get stronger as we age. Comparisons? Stop doing them. Just stop. They're just stories that we make up. They're just stories. Stories aren't real. They're just stories. And instead of a comparing, when someone is talking, why don't we begin to do something very benedictive and listen with the ears of our heart? That deep listening, which I have found over the years, is just so therapeutic to the person who wants to call. Because I work for a large corporation, which is good. It's got them profit-minded. I can tell when I'm talking to a manager, having the best, but not right now, and he's in front of me, physically. His mind is on, and we've all, I think, had the experience, his mind is on what's going to come next. But when we can actually be present to people, what a gift we give. And same thing with expectations and anticipations, just stop having them. Just stop. Competition, just stop your behavior, whatever it is that makes you do that. And judgments. Just stop judging. And that this is, the judging is a little glass, trust me. I've been trying it for many years. But just when you find yourself judging, just stop. And maybe turn it around. And maybe like turn it upside down and look for opportunities to praise and compliment other people instead of judging them. Why, you did a great job. Thank you. I had an opportunity to do a retreat a couple years ago with the Secular Institute of Balkas Day. And I came away with three gems that they had as part of their rule. Lack of criticism. How about that? Lack of, and this is what, how they run their meetings. Lack of complaint. And practice 5 acts of charity every day. And as we do those type of things, as we stop criticizing, shut them out. And then part of my journey with the judgments and the criticism, I have found that not only do people not need them, my judgments, they do not want them. And if you have children, especially adult children, they probably want them even less. Even less than other people. One of my friends, a teacher sent in prayer in New Jersey, said that at one point in time she had the blessing of having 2 adult children live in her house. They had gone and they came back. And she really meant that. And one of her daughters was having problems with work. And she was coming home every day, sharing her problems at work with her mother, and her mother was giving her suggestions. And then the mother found out, after doing this for a couple weeks, that the daughter was saying the same things. So she decided it wasn't working. So she would stop doing what she was doing. The daughter would come home with the same things everywhere. And she would listen. Once again, that powerful gift of listening with the ears of our heart. And after a couple of weeks of that, Joan turned to her mother and she said, "Mom, thanks so much for listening to me and not judging." Because when her mother was giving her things to do, you know, suggestions, her daughter felt she was being judged. So to listen. And then another antidote to judgment is to practice mercy. Mercy, which is tender, giving, an awareness of the value of others, and an awareness of our value in God's eyes. Just as a side note, Pope Francis delivered a TED talk. Technology, entertainment, and design, those talks, which is usually about innovation. It was done remotely. His TED talk was on, it was just recently, I think it might have been this week or the past week, tenderness. And spoke about the need for tenderness. Powerful stuff. So what I'd like to do right now, and then we can, after we do this, I'll answer Sharon if we have any questions. I'd like to lead us through Lexio Divina. And so if you just relax, I'll lead you through the process, and then we'll share anything else I see after we finish it. So as I read the scripture passage for the first time, I invite you to become aware of any word or phrase that touches you. A word or a phrase. And I'll read it four times, pausing in between each moment, and then at the end, I'll invite any share that you'd like to offer. So as I listen, read these for the first time, a word or a phrase. So get rid of your old self, which made you live as you used to. The old self that was being destroyed by its deceitful desires. Your hearts and minds must be made completely new. And you must put on the new self, which is created in God's likeness and reveals itself in the true life that is upright and whole. We listen to the word of God for the second time, I invite you to become aware of any reflection you have. And if possible, make that a personal reflection using I or my or me. So get rid of your old self, which made you live as you used to. The old self that was being destroyed by its deceitful desire. Your hearts and minds must be made completely new. And you must put on the new self, which is created in God's likeness and reveals itself in the true life that is upright and whole. As we listen to the word of God for the third time, I invite you to become aware of any prayer that rises from your heart. Prayer from your heart. So get rid of your old self, which made you live as you used to. The old self that was being destroyed by its deceitful desires. Your hearts and minds must be made completely new. And you must put on the new self, which is created in God's likeness and reveals itself in the true life that is upright and whole. And as we listen to the word of God for the fourth time, I invite you to simply rest in the word. Rest in the power of the word. So get rid of your old self, which made you live as you used to. The old self that was being destroyed by its deceitful desires. Your hearts and minds must be made completely new. And you must put on the new self, which is created in God's likeness and reveals itself in the true life that is upright and whole. And I invite anyone who would like to do so to share a word of grace, reflection, or prayer.
I am dwelling upon this passage and thinking about it and meditating on it. It sounds very holy and very spiritual and very profound. But as I've struggled with this and struggled with my aversion, etc., I think there's a deep flaw in it, because St. Paul also says that you have died and your life is hidden with Christ in God. So in a very real self, in a real sense, the concept of an old self that I, the self, needs to get rid of to put on the new self, that very thinking is a product of the old judging, critical, comparing self. So that, you know, I have died and my life is hidden with Christ and God. It is no longer I who live right now. The old self is dead. So it's not what I need to do, I thinking about me and my self-consciousness, the practices that I need to do to get rid of what I don't want. It's that I have this new life. I am, we're temples of God, and that Spirit of God dwells in us. When I'm clinging in my thinking, when I'm attached to my thoughts and thinking, I'm bringing into being that very self-consciousness that's not permitting me to simply just be present right here, right now. And so that if I look at aversion, and it's certainly true that aversions and these things are negative in consequence, but yet by the same token, how can one really learn humility if one doesn't give in to on occasions, you know, these things that we feel that we have to get rid of. So the attitude that it's like he who would save his life must lose it. I am the vine, you are the branches. Apart from me, you can do nothing. Well, I already have that union. It's just to have faith that I am that new creation now already. And instead of thinking about getting rid of this old self, and attaining to some state where I'm free of this, it's to, the way that I actually can do that is not to think about the self. When I experience aversion, to be present to it simply as aversion, give it space, you know, and then allow it to go with the faith that it's not I, but Christ in me. I can let it go. I don't have to get rid of it. I need to simply be who God is creating me to be, right here, right now, in that new creation, which I already am. So, I mean, that's how my thinking about old, put on the old self is.
This actually harks back to when I traveled quite a lot with my daughter in the car to take her back and forth, and we used to listen to this program. She was very young, and they actually did a kind of radio skit on this, which was a great explanation of what they were talking about. And they were talking to one of the characters, that he was putting on the new him, but he overlaid it over the old and never took the new off. And what happened immediately, there was kind of a trembling of the earth, and everybody knew something was not right, but they couldn't figure it out. And as the play went on, things got not only worse for the character, but it got worse for everybody around the character, to the point where at one point, the little island they were on was tilting, until one of the wiser character comes by and says, "What is underneath your jacket?" He goes, "What do you mean?" He goes, "Open that up." And he goes, "Okay, I figured it out." He said, "You're supposed to take the old off because you run back to it and want to do those things. What we're trying and what God is trying to let you know is you can put the old off, leave it behind, never even touch it again. Don't worry about it. It's not something that you need to worry or feel that you need to reach back to, because the new one will take care of you." And it actually started a bit of a conversation with my daughter. And I just thought that was just a great way to explain in almost a physical sense, in a simplistic sense, what he was trying to get at. And it kind of just ties right into the addiction issues. I mean, everybody has addictions. It's, you know, it's the running back to, this gives me comfort, but not realizing it's not really giving you comfort. It's setting up a wall so you're not feeling what you want, and therefore you're not engaging deeper in God. So I just thought it was a really good thing.
It kind of almost feels that like a series of affirmations in the last two lines, you know, complete, you know, completely new. So it's almost like what you said, they're really, should be no compromise or lukewarmness. It has to be like total, but it actually has been concretized in the last two words. Building before that was new self, God's likeness, true life, but that is really the essence of living an upright and holy life, which is sort of what all those other words are referring to ultimately. You know, how we live out an upright life relative to our fellow man, and how we live a holy life relative to God and our fellow man as well. That gives me a blueprint, if you will, on how to proceed following, say, a conversion experience or a realization or a desire for for change. And these two tenets, I think, being upright and being holy, are the anchors of what Jesus had called us to do. You know, love God and your neighbor as yourself. Love God with all your heart and your neighbor as yourself. So I think it's wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank
you.
Yeah, self sticks out for me. The psychological equivalent of self is ego. My biggest judgment is my self-judgments. I'm such a jerk. And, well, no, it's true. You know what I mean. And then the prayer that comes to mind is, Lord, have mercy on me, the sinner.
And what really jumped out at me was the word true life. Because I've always struggled in my life and thought about it, meditate on it. What really is, you know, the truth? I think the truth is, of God and all that. But I mean, the whole truth is very hard to grasp in this world. But I think there are some truths that we can discover and try to lead us to, living the holy and upright life. But the truth is somewhat intimidating because I think it's difficult to know. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't strive towards it in any way we're able to. But that's always been big for me, the truth in trying to live whatever that might be.
Thank you.